Thanks very much, Scott, and thanks to ISDA for the opportunity to speak to you all today. So what I'd like to talk about is the ongoing reform effort around interest rate benchmarks. Reform of interest rate benchmarks has been a key focus of central banks and financial regulators over recent years. These benchmarks are referenced in a wide range of financial contracts, including derivatives, loans and securities. In light of the issues around LIBOR and other interest rate benchmarks that have risen over the past decade, substantial effort has gone into reforming these benchmarks to support the smooth functioning of the financial system. So what I'd like to do today is provide you with an update on the work underway to strengthen these interest rate benchmarks. I'll focus on the developments since last year's announcement by the FCA in the UK on the future of LIBOR. In particular, I'll also highlight the important role for risk-free interest rates as an alternative to credit-based benchmarks such as LIBOR. I'll then summarise the work underway to ensure that the major interest rate benchmark in my country, the bank bill swap rate, or BBSW, remains robust for the long term. So if any of you are investors in products which reference BBSW, this is going to be particularly relevant to you, but it also stands in some sense as a contrast to the work going on around the LIBOR. So I'll explain how credit-based benchmarks such as BBSW can coexist with risk-free rates in a post-LIBOR world. Central banks and financial regulators have been working with the industry and with ISDA to address the shortcomings in the major interest rate benchmarks, the IBORs. For several years, the Financial Stability Board has had a group which has been monitoring progress in three different directions. One, to strengthen the IBORs by anchoring them to a greater number of transactions and improve benchmark governance. Secondly, to identify robust alternative risk-free rates and encourage derivatives to be referenced to them instead of the IBORs. And thirdly, to ensure that the very large number of contracts which reference IBORs include robust fallback provisions to reduce the risk of financial instability if an IBOR were to be discontinued. So as you know, IBORs are the key interest rate benchmarks for several major currencies, including most obviously the US dollar and pound sterling. In July last year, Andrew Bailey, who heads the FCA, raised some serious questions about the sustainability or the longevity of LIBOR. The key problem he identified is that there are not enough transactions in the short-term interbank funding market to reliably calculate LIBOR. The banks that make the submissions used to calculate it are uncomfortable about continuing to do this, as they have to rely mainly on their own expert judgment in determining whether LIBOR should, where LIBOR should be, rather than actually using transactions. So to prevent LIBOR from abruptly ceasing to exist, the FCA has received assurances from the current banks on the LIBOR panel that they will continue to submit their estimates to sustain LIBOR until the end of 2021. But beyond that point, beyond 2021, there is no guarantee that LIBOR will continue to exist. The FCA is not going to compel banks to provide submissions, and the panel banks may not voluntarily continue to do so. So let me make that clear. LIBOR is not under threat because of the regulators. Rather, it's been kept going to date because of the actions of regulators, but that isn't going to occur beyond 2021. Then it comes beyond 2021, it comes down to whether the submitting banks are willing to maintain LIBOR in its current form, and there is no guarantee at all that that's going to be the case. So Andrew Bailey made this announcement last year to give market participants enough time to transition away from LIBOR, but that process is clearly not straightforward. LIBOR is referenced in around $350 trillion worth of contracts globally at the moment. A large share of those contracts do have short durations, often 3 months or less, so they will roll off well ahead of 2021. But when they roll off, they should not continue to be replaced with another short-dated contract referencing LIBOR, as generally seems to be the case today. But beyond those shorter-term contracts, a very sizable number of current contracts extend beyond 2021, with some lasting as long as 100 years. So market participants that use LIBOR need to work on transitioning their contracts to alternative reference rates. That transition is clearly going to involve a substantial amount of work for users of LIBOR, both to amend contracts and to update systems. So given how hard it has been to sustain LIBOR, regulators around the world have been working closely with the industry to identify alternative risk-free rates that can be used instead of LIBOR in some cases. These alternative rates are based on overnight funding markets, since there are plenty of transactions in those markets generally to calculate robust benchmarks. So for example, and as I'm sure Joshua Frost will talk about in the next session, the New York Fed began publishing the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR, as the recommended alternative to the US dollar LIBOR. For pound sterling, SONIA has been identified as the alternative risk-free rate, and the Bank of England has recently put in place reforms to ensure that it remains a robust benchmark. One issue is that the chosen risk-free rates are overnight rates, while LIBOR is clearly a term rate. Some market participants would prefer for the LIBOR replacement to also be term rates. So while the development of term risk-free rates is on the long-term agenda for some currencies, they are unlikely to be available anytime soon. This reflects that there are currently not enough transactions in markets for term risk-free rates, such as OIS, to support robust benchmarks. Given this reality, it is very important that users of LIBOR are planning their transitions to the overnight risk-free benchmarks that are available, such as SOFR for the US dollar and SONIA for the pound sterling. For the risk-free rates to provide an alternative to LIBOR, the next challenge is to generate sufficient liquidity in derivative products that reference those risk-free rates. This will take some time. So in the US, as I said, SOFR is only recently starting being published. Nevertheless, progress is being made with the first futures contract referencing SOFR recently being launched, and I'm sure Joshua will again talk about this in a second. Market participants also need to be prepared for a scenario where the LIBOR benchmarks abruptly cease to be published. In such an event, users would have to rely on the fallback provisions in their contracts. However, for many products, the existing fallback provisions would be cumbersome to apply and could generate significant market disruption. For example, a number of the contracts envisage that in the event of LIBOR not being there, the solution is ring up a bank and ask them where they think LIBOR is. Basically, it was put in place for a scenario where there was some technological reason why LIBOR is not published, not because no one actually wished to make a submission to LIBOR. To address this risk, the FSB has been encouraged ISDA to work with market participants to develop a more suitable fallback than what is envisaged in most contracts currently, and one which uses the risk-free rates that have been identified. But clearly, LIBOR is very different from an overnight risk-free rate, as it includes bank credit risk and it is a term rate. So the key challenge is to agree on a standard methodology for calculating credit and term spreads that can be added to the risk-free rate to construct a fallback for LIBOR. This needs to be resolved as soon as possible, and we encourage users of LIBOR to engage with ISDA on this important work. Let me now talk a little bit about the reforms that are underway here in Australia. The key IBOR benchmark for the Australian dollar is BBSW. So ourselves, along with our securities regulator ASIC, have been working closely with industry to ensure that BBSW remains robust. So the critical difference between BBSW and LIBOR is that here in Australia, there are enough transactions in the local market each day to calculate a robust benchmark. Australia has an active bank bill market where the four major banks here issue bills as a regular source of funding, and a wide range of wholesale investors purchase those bills as a liquid cash management tool. So here we do have enough transactions so we can calculate a transactions-based benchmark. The difference with LIBOR is that LIBOR is a submission-based benchmark and there aren't enough transactions. So for several years here, BBSW has been calculated from a best bid and offer for the bills on tradable platforms. Until recently, a significant concern we've had has been the low trading volumes in the interbank market at the time that that calculation is being measured. So while there are enough transactions over the course of the day, there was nowhere near enough occurring in the small rate set window. So having talked with market participants on why there was a lack of trading during the rate set, they gave us a couple of reasons. First of all, they faced a potential conflict of interest when they participated in the market underpinning the benchmark and the derivatives market that also references it. and they're unsure how regulators expected them to manage those conflicts. And secondly, the buy side generally were reluctant to trade at outright yields. They preferred to transact at the yet-to-be-determined rate set, since this minimised their tracking error against their performance benchmarks. So to address those two issues, two key steps have been taken to support BBSW going forward. First, the methodology has been strengthened to enable the benchmark to be calculated directly from the wider set of market transactions that occur each day. So we've widened the window to pick up a greater set of those transactions. That won't work for LIBOR because, as I said, again, there just aren't enough transactions. Secondly, we've introduced a new regulatory framework for financial benchmarks. So the work on implementing the new calculation methodology is progressing well and is likely to go completely live next week. So it uses a VWAP of the bank bill transactions that occur each day in a longer window than we use currently. So it includes transactions outside the interbank market during a longer trading window. This reflects the fact that bank holdings of bills have declined over recent years to around a tenth of total issuance, and really it's the buy side, the investment funds, which are the main buyers of those bills. Those investors had purchased bank bills outside the rate set window. Now they're going to be purchasing those bills inside the bank rate set window. So we have a strong expectation that the buy side is going to be trading those bills at outright yields during the rate set window. This change in market practice has been successfully implemented already, and so we've been running a parallel arrangement over the last few weeks to check that it actually works, and the ASX, the Securities Exchange here, is going to likely go live with this in the next week or two. On average, there are around $1.5 billion worth in transactions during the rate set each day, with a wide range of institutions participating. On nearly all days, it has been possible to calculate the key 3-month and 6-month rates using a VWAP methodology. In addition, the difference between the VWAP calculation and the existing NBBO method is pretty much zero. So given these results, we expect there should be a seamless transition to the new methodology in the next few weeks. The parallel run that has gone on has confirmed that the most robust tenors are 3 and 6 months, which are the tenors most frequently referenced in derivatives. Despite that, there are still many contracts that reference 1 month BBSW. There are liquidity of 1 month BBSW is a lot lower than it once was, and so we would suggest that users of products referencing 1 month BBSW, which includes mortgage-backed securities, for example, should consider referencing a 3 or 6 month rate going forward. The VWAP methodology will be at the top of a robust calculation waterfall for BBSW, so the benchmark can continue to be published as conditions change in the market. If there are not transactions on enough transactions on a day, it will instead fall back to using NBBO, and if quotes aren't available, there are algorithms that can be used to calculate the benchmark for a time. So these are the sort of fallback provisions that we encourage all users of benchmark rates to start looking to have embedded in their contracts. To rebuild confidence in trading during the rate set window, the Stock Exchange has worked closely with market participants to develop a new set of trading guidelines for the rate set. These guidelines are an important part of the new methodology as they provide guidance on the trading for bank bills during the rate set window. The securities regulator ASIC and ourselves have made it clear that they expect all bank bill market participants, including the banks that issue the bank bills, as well as the participants that buy them, to adhere to the guidelines and support the new methodology. Turning to the second key step to help ensure that BBSW remains robust, the Australian Government has recently introduced a new regulatory framework for financial benchmarks. The legislation empowers the securities regulators to set the rules for and license administrators of significant benchmarks such as BBSW. ASIC will also have the power to compel submissions to a significant benchmark in the rare circumstances where the benchmark would otherwise cease to be published. Finally, the legislation makes it an offence to manipulate financial benchmarks. This new regulatory framework has helped to address the uncertainty that institutions were facing when participating in the benchmark setting process. It should also support the continuing use of BBSW in jurisdictions such as the European Union, where new regulations require benchmarks used in the EU to be subject to a robust regulatory framework, And similar issues apply in Hong Kong around recognition of benchmarks by the EU. And the HKMA and the securities regulator in Hong Kong are very much working on this issue too. While we expect that BBSW will remain a robust benchmark, it is important for market participants to ask whether a credit-based benchmark is the most appropriate benchmark for financial contracts. And again, I would encourage you to do that if you're using LIBOR as well. Do I need to have a credit-based benchmark as the interest rate benchmark in my contract? Or should I instead be considering shifting to a risk-free rate? For some financial products, it can make sense to reference a risk-free rate instead of a credit-based benchmark. Floating rate notes issued by governments, non-financial corporations and securitisations trusts, for example, which are currently priced at a spread to a credit rate, could instead tie their coupon payments to a risk-free rate. As the RBA's operational target for monetary policy and the reference rate for OIS and other financial contracts, the cash rate is the risk-free interest rate benchmark in Australia. We, the RBA, measure the cash rate directly from transactions in the interbank overnight cash market, and we have ensured our methodology is in line with the IOSCO principles for benchmarks. However, consistent with the challenges faced by users of LIBOR looking to transition to alternative risk-free rates, the cash rate is clearly not a perfect substitute for BBSW in all its uses, as it is an overnight rate rather than a term rate, and it doesn't incorporate a significant bank credit risk premium. But we think that BBSW can continue to exist even if credit-based benchmarks such as LIBOR are discontinued in other jurisdictions. So for products such as those issued by banks, a credit-based benchmark probably is going to make sense going forward. The counterparty of these products will still need derivatives that reference BBSW or another credit-based benchmark so that they can hedge their interest rate exposures. In the event that LIBOR was to be discontinued, though, with contracts transitioning to risk-free rates, there may be some corresponding migration away from BBSW here in Australia towards a risk-free rate benchmark. The infrastructure is already in place for BBSW and the cash rate to coexist as the key interest rate benchmarks for the Australian dollar. We have an OIS market linked to the cash rate and has been operating for 20 years, so we do actually have decent term liquidity at the short end. And the infrastructure is in place for longer term risk-free rate benchmarks. A functioning derivatives market for trading the basis between the benchmarks is important for BBSW and the cash rate to smoothly coexist. Such a basis swap market is also in place already, allowing market participants to exchange the cash flows under these benchmarks. So let me finish by trying to just hammer home the three main points I want to leave with you concerning interest rate benchmarks. First, and probably most importantly, the longevity of LIBOR cannot be assumed. That is very much the message that Andrew Bailey was delivering last year and continues to deliver, and is very much the one I want to leave you with today. You should be considering right now what that might mean for you for any contracts you have that reference LIBOR should it cease to exist. Please do not hope that if you wait long enough, the problem's going to go away. There is no guarantee that that's going to happen. Users of LIBOR should pay close attention to the work being undertaken by ISDA to establish more robust fallback provisions on these contracts. Secondly, in the Australian market, in contrast to some other markets, the changes to enhance the longevity of the credit-based benchmark BBSW here are well advanced, and it has been possible to anchor the benchmark to a greater number of transactions, and so we will maintain a transaction-based benchmark going forward. But users should still consider whether risk-free benchmarks are more appropriate for their financial contracts than credit-based benchmarks. There is still a place for robust credit-based benchmarks in the financial infrastructure, and we expect the BBSW and the risk-free rate, the cash rate here, will be able to coexist as the key benchmarks for the Australian dollar. But to conclude, the one thing message I really would like you to take away today is that you really should be thinking about how you're going to be able to be resilient to the longevity of LIBOR. There is no guarantee that LIBOR will be in place past 2021. So let me finish there, and Scott, I think happy to take some questions from there.
If that message wasn't clear, then you have to put your phones down because it was a very clear set of priorities and objectives that you've set out. But let me ask you one question. What do you make of the progress the industry has made thus far in your conversations with either regulators or market participants in terms of readiness and observations? You've laid out what needs to happen. What's your level of confidence and comfort that those things are being accomplished right now?
Not that high, I would say. I think, so on the regulatory side, there is a very clear recognition of what needs to be accomplished. We're seeing quite a bit of progress on the risk-free, alternative risk-free rates, particularly over the last few months. I mentioned what's happened in the US market with SOFR starting to be published. So that's happening. I think there's very much a recognition on the banks' side that something needs to change because they are the ones themselves who may not be willing to submit to LIBOR going forward. I suppose, and without trying to be too unfair, I think there's not so much of a recognition on the buy side of the market or on other users of LIBOR about, you know, as I said, I think there's a bit of a hope that someone will come along and fix this problem for them and that it might all go away. And I just don't think you can be confident that that's going to happen. It may happen. I'm not saying it's guaranteed that LIBOR is going to disappear in 2021, but I would certainly not be assuming that it won't. And I do recognize that there's a hell of a lot of systems work and legal work involved in this. And that, again, as I said, is why Andrew put people on notice last year to try and give them enough time to adjust to this potential state of affairs. But as I said, assuming that this problem is all going to go away or that someone else is going to sort it out for you is probably not going to be a sensible strategy.
Well put. You did mention, and you just articulated again, that steps have been taken to make LIBOR more robust, and as this is a voluntary effort, there people, you know, it's up to them to take this action. If there is a possibility of LIBOR existing post 2021, what do you think needs to happen to LIBOR in terms of maturities or tenors reducing it that might make it more acceptable or more robust going forward, if at all?
I suppose it's not clear to me that we're going to end up in a world where there's going to be enough transactions. I don't see that. I wouldn't be counting on that coming back. And so therefore, it really boils down to whether the banks which currently submit to LIBOR are going to be willing to do so going forward. And I just don't have any great sense as to whether or not they're going to be. I suppose what I would encourage is the work that you're doing at ISDA is, so if you're not confident, at the very least, you should have fallback provisions which are actually going to work in the contracts. And that's very much the work that we're encouraging ISDA to do with the industry so that maybe LIBOR does exist, but I want to be confident that if there is some chance that actually it doesn't exist, that I've got fallback provisions which are actually going to make sense. Whereas if I look at a number of the ones which are out there at the moment, if LIBOR is not working, they're not going to work either. And so, as I said, that's very much the motivation for the work that you're doing at ISDA.
Thank you. Now, I want to remind all our participants in the audience, you do have the ability to send questions to the Deputy Governor. I have the computer up here that I'm happy to read off your questions to him, but I've got a few of my own in the bag here, so please send them up. You mentioned that Australia is actually one of the few jurisdictions with a legislative solution moving forward. Europe, the European Commission has also implemented legislative standards. The fact that the U.S., for example, has not taken steps to establish a benchmark initiative or reform, does that trouble you at all?
No, I mean, in the end, I mean, they do what they do, and we all the rest of us have to adjust to that. I mean, as I said, I think what is encouraging, though, is the development of the risk-free benchmark in the US. That's been resolved. It's now out there. They have the group that Sandy O'Connor from JP is leading, developing around benchmark rates is getting stuff done. So that actually does encourage me. It's not obvious. It depends. You know, it's not obvious to me that all jurisdictions need a legislated solution. Our issue here was we had no legislation at all around benchmarks previously, really, and we do now. So to some extent was rectifying that deficiency in our market. It's not obvious to me that you need to do that in the US market. What I think is more encouraging development is the fact that we now have a risk-free rate up and running and even some decent sign of a term structure, that free, that risk-free rate being in the process of being developed.
Here's a question for the audience, very good question, in fact. Has the RBA and or ASIC engaged ESMA and the Commission on seeking recognition for BBSW?
Yep. Yes, it's the short answer to that question. Yes, we have. ASIC is very much engaged on that in getting, and in part, now that the legislation is actually in place, it is legislation which we expect should be recognised by ESMA as being an equivalent regime. So they had recognised the previous methodology we had around BBSW, but with the new benchmark legislation kicking in, I think, on the 1st of January this year, ASIC is engaged with them in getting the fact that we have legislation actually in place, getting that equivalency regime recognised.
Fantastic. There are a lot of, I raised it in my remarks, establishing clearing, establishing futures markets around some of these new rates in order to give market participants all the tools that they would need to voluntarily transition and have, great reference prices on different structures over different terms, even though, it's moving to risk-free rates. Is there anything that regulators can be doing to help facilitate that transition, to accelerate that process, engaging with the market infrastructures, clearing CCPs, et cetera, on kind of a more holistic basis to move that discussion along?
I think they are engaging. That's my sense. You can put the question to the next speaker as well. We engage with those various parts of the infrastructure here in our local market. I also think it's and there has been a little bit of a chicken and egg problem that I won't start using a risk-free rate until the term rate's there, but the term rate won't be there until I start actually using it. But I do think there are a number of people that are sufficiently incentivized to get that market up and running, not least of which being the banks, and you are actually starting to see that market develop. And I do also think that once that market does, as it starts to develop, I think you think more and more, and you can be guaranteed of liquidity and the various other parts of the infrastructure that you mentioned around it, then I think you'll be able, the migration path will be much more smooth for other market participants. So once it reaches enough critical mass, and, I think the indications there are actually reasonably positive, then I think it becomes self-reinforcing.
Okay. Apparently, we also have a Mr. Microphone out there. So if you don't want to type in your question, you're more than welcome to raise your hand, and we will send you a microphone around. What about the relationship between the buy side, sell side? When you made the comment chicken or egg, that really epitomizes that relationship and trying to figure out. I think the banks are more keenly aware of what's gone on. They participated in the various risk-free rate working groups in the public-private sector. Only more recently have end users, buy-side insurance, asset management participated in these broader remits. Can you reflect on where kind of the buy-side writ large is thinking, how they're thinking about it and the level of their readiness?
Yeah, I mean, I think the banks sort of got there first because, to some extent, they were directly involved in the process, in the benchmark setting process. They directly fined as a result, in some cases, of being involved in that benchmark setting process. So that tended to concentrate their minds on the longevity of LIBOR. But for other market participants, I suppose, it's still there, so why do I need to worry? I think, as I said, it's really just a question of getting the message out there at forums like this. And I think the fact that Andrew made that speech last year really does set a time frame. So it's not some indefinite point in the future. You can actually point to a time where beyond that, you've really got to be, you can't be assured that things are going to continue as they are. I think up until recently, there was a presumption that something, I don't know what that something was going to be, that something would come along and sort all this out, and I just wouldn't have to worry about it. I think the message which we're trying to get out there now is there isn't obviously a something which is going to come along and sort it out. And it's really just a question of getting that into people's heads. I think now also that there's a clear alternative rather than a hypothetical alternative makes it easier for people to consider how they're going to transition away from LIBOR. In the past, up until fairly recently, it was this hypothetical thing that they were going to transition to. Now you can actually point to something which is actually there.
One of the things we've picked up in our survey is it goes even a step lower, kind of into some retail products. And ISDA, we're quite lucky because we do have the legal flexibility around protocols to make the adjustments to support the fallback efforts and to amend contracts broadly. Now, other contracts do not have the flexibility in their contracts. Now, you noted accurately, of course, that many of these contracts roll off in a short period of time. So hopefully the maturities will phase out. But what do we do with, in the case that we may have some very long dated, potentially some retail products referencing LIBOR that don't have the flexibility to easily amend through protocols like the derivatives market? What do you recommend, and or how do regulators think about some of those products?
So I suppose that's still one of the remaining challenges. I mean, and that's why the work is ongoing, because I don't think as of this stage there's an obvious solution to that, and I think that still needs work as to how that's going to play out. And it may play out slightly differently in different jurisdictions. But that, to some extent, I think that's a question which is yet to be resolved.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Now, we have a question from one of our audience submission. Here's the question. Regulations now give authority to compel submissions. Will this approach yield accurate submissions? What confidence under LIBOR do you have, other than the fact that you're watching it very closely and we've made it more robust, do you believe that the current LIBOR submissions are more accurate?
I think the incentive to, I mean, in the UK and in the case of the legislation which has just come into being here in Australia, you know, you're fairly much incentivized because the penalties for not doing it accurately are pretty high. So, and that's been demonstrated particularly in around LIBOR. So I think, you know, as I've said, I spent a lot of time, as Scott mentioned earlier, trying to sort out some issues in the foreign exchange industry over the past few years. And the same thing applies on the interest rate benchmark front, is that the odd billion-dollar fine tends to focus people's minds in terms of providing their submissions on best endeavours. That sort of crystallises quite clearly the cost of not doing that. But an important thing to note, though, on the submission front, so while it is the case that submissions can be compelled around LIBOR in the UK at the moment, as Andrew said, there's a finite life on that, which is hence the date of 2021. There is only a finite period over which they can actually do that. And that's why we can't rely on that being the case going forward. Submissions won't be compelled post 2021.
Well, I think we've reached the end of the questions here. You've been very generous with your time, and thank you for cooperating via teleconference to make this happen. Quite remarkably, it all went very smoothly, given some of the challenges we face. So let me ask the audience to give Governor DeBell one last round of applause.